Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I don't know that we'll be hearing too much from Caroline in the future. She's turned 90 this month, and she's decided that maybe she's not going to be participating too much on Writers' Voices anymore. But I'm keeping her in the title anyway, because we did it together for 19 years. Yeah. So our guest today on Writers' Voices is Lori Gold, author of Romantic Friction. Now, Lori is the author of an adult historical and four novels for young adults, all under the name Lori Goldstein. She currently lives outside of Boston, where she fosters a writing community through her creative writing classes, book coaching, and writing retreats. And she can be found online at www.LoriGoldsteinBooks.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, or welcome back to Writer's Voices, I should say, Lori.
Yes, thank you for having me again, Monica. It's great to be here. And wow, that's amazing about Caroline.
I know, I know. You know, she had a career in radio earlier, and she did a daily talk show in our local community station for years, and then then she went back to teaching, and then after she retired from that, she had a weekly talk show on a local Christian radio station. And so when this opportunity to do the show on a local nonprofit low power station came up, I asked her to do it with me, and so that's how we started. And then we segued into podcasting, as happens. But we are still on two radio stations. So shout out to the people listening to us on KHOE and in Fairfield and KICI in Iowa City.
So, great.
Yeah. So, Lori, the last time you were here, you were Lori Goldstein, and now you're Lori Gold. And I think that has a lot to do with this book. So tell us that story.
So the change from Lori Goldstein to Lori Gold is one that's easily recognizable. I didn't change my social media, I didn't change my website, but this is a brand new genre for me. And so changing to Lori Gold was identifying this and me as an author in book club fiction versus the other things I've written. My first four novels were young adult novels, and they were under Lori Goldstein. And when I wrote my adult historical fiction, we wanted to differentiate it partly because that character was young. She was 19. She was Theodosia Burr. The novel is Love, Theodosia, and was based on the historical woman of Theodosia Burr. And we didn't want the age of 19 to make people think it was a young adult book. So we added my middle name of Anne, Lori Anne Goldstein. Then when that was on the cover, when they were doing the cover design, we realized that's a lot of letters to put as an author name. And it was kind of difficult to get it on there, to get it on the spine. And so it was in my head when I was switching to this book club fiction, what do I do? Do I go back to just Lori Goldstein? Has it been long enough since I've written the YA that we're differentiated? And, you know, my team talked and we said, you know what? Lori Gold is short. It'll look good on the cover. and it'll clearly be a differentiation from everything you've written before. So that's what I'll be going forward.
Now, is there some danger of you know, because those young adult books were a while ago, that audience now might be the same audience for this book? And so is there some risk of losing that audience because they don't recognize, because they might say, oh, I read her YA books when I was a teenager, and now look what she's writing, and I'll read this.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a possibility. And those are the pros and cons you weigh, like what do you lose versus what you gain? And, you know, part of it, it looks, you know, it's a book club debut, which it is. So kind of combined with the name change, you hope you even get a little bit more publicity attention when you do something like that. So you kind of weigh all of these factors and figure out where you land.
Okay. Now, your character in Romantic Friction is also trying to make a genre change, but a little bit different. So she was writing romantic fiction.
Romantasy.
Yeah. So romantic fantasy.
Romance.
And wants to move into
more just straight romance without the fantasy. As she says in the book, she doesn't want to, as you said, lose her audience to go then do thrillers or something that would be completely outside the expectation for her. But she wanted to spread her wings a little bit, stay in the romance world, but maybe drop the fantasy that she'd been writing for 10 years, because it's a 10-book series that she's written in the book. So she was ready for a change.
And is that common, do you think, that authors want to make some change in the genre? They have success in one genre and then they want to branch out?
Absolutely. I think it happens. You know, it's a double-edged sword, right? It's a curse to say my readers want this from me, but as an author, you kind of want to be able to do different things and write in different genres. I think it's a good problem to have, that you have so much success that you're writing books to cater to that audience. That's okay.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, and some writers write under completely different pen names and don't attach them to themselves, so they can write something very, very different, and that does happen. But I think, you know, we're creative people, and our minds go everywhere with story ideas, and they don't always fall in the same genre you're writing. So sometimes people wait. They wait till, you know, once you have your, 5, 6, 7, 8 very successful book, you have more readers who will probably go with you to another genre. But straight out, you're really trying to cultivate that readership that then will travel with you.
Right, right. So this book, Romantic Friction, is really all about writing, publishing, publicizing books. And how much of this is from your own experience?
Yeah, so it's definitely an inside publishing story. It's things that I think some published authors don't even know of what goes on behind the scenes when a book is acquired, when they're discussing marketing tactics for it and publicity tactics for it, as you said. And it's all true. So everything that happens in the book, every anecdote I relay is something that either happened to me personally or something that I know is true from a writer friend. So it's a no holds barred look. And to be honest, this is published by HarperCollins, and I was a little surprised that they didn't ask me to change anything or soften anything, because it goes there. Things that, you know, people would be surprised about. I'll give a little spoiler of one thing I talk about, but Sophie relays an anecdote that one of the other authors in the book, who's quite attractive, was told by her marketing team that she was given a higher advance, the money they pay to publish the book, because she was attractive and would look good on a book poster. That is a true story.
Wow.
That one didn't happen to me. That's someone I know. So all of these things that happen in the story are absolutely true. Nothing's made up.
Well, I'm hoping maybe not the kidnapping.
Yes, well, that's not inside publishing, so I can see that happening.
So tell us, kind of give us a broad outline of this story.
Yeah, so it is about, as we said, Sophie Wilde, who is a best-selling romanticy author, and she's at the height of her career when she's contemplating this change in genre, but she's really at the height of this career as a romanticy author. Her 10th book in her series is releasing, and she's celebrating that, and this is when she discovers that another author has used artificial intelligence, AI, to write a book like Sophie. And instead of being canceled, as we might expect, that book and author are embraced. Social media, she's trending on social media. She's called innovative in the press. And Sophie is understandably livid. And so when Sophie arrives at the largest romance readers convention in the country, which she is supposed to headline, and discovers that the AI author has also been invited, she bands together with her fellow authors to take that AI author down any way they can, which includes committing a felony, which you said will be a kidnapping.
Yeah. Now, Sophie is not an entirely likable heroine.
At the start, hopefully.
Yep. And I'm curious about why. I mean, you made her pretty prickly.
Yes. Yeah. Purposefully so.
Right. So why? What was the thinking behind that?
So when I think about creating a character, I want to create a character that, one, will have some sort of growth arc. So I want them to have a transformation. I want the experiences they go through to change who they are in some way. So you always, or in my mind, I always want to start maybe a little extreme in whatever their overarching trait is, so the reader can track how that changes throughout the story. So that's part of it. For Sophie to be kind of prickly, as you said, and judgmental and opinionated, in some ways, it's to cement her as a character who has been in this business a long time and feels like she's earned her success. And someone coming to take that away from her in a way that she feels is unearned is such an affront to her. And it's even more of an affront to her because she is somewhat of a judgmental person. But the other reason that I think is even the biggest reason for me is Sophie is a bit of a lone wolf because she's judgmental, because she's opinionated and prickly. So she doesn't have this stash of author friends behind her or to commiserate with or to say, can you believe this happened? Can you help me with this? She's ultimately going to have to ask this group of women who she's not been friendly with to help her with this situation she's in. So her kind of extreme personality makes it much harder for people to want to help her. So why will they? And will they get behind her? And does she have to grovel to them to ask them to come help her? So it sets her up as a character who is in the worst position to have to ask for help because of her behavior and who she's been. That just makes for better storytelling.
Right, right. Now, there is also a romantic element. But you don't go too deep into that. It's not a primary aspect of the book.
And I think that's the danger with the romantic friction as a title. It's a cool play on words. Yes. And even as we were choosing, I said, well, I don't want people to think it's a romance because it's not. It's got a light romance thread, but it's really about friendship and it's really about career and ambition. And those are the focuses of the book. So there is a light romance. It takes place only over a couple of days. So it can't be a heavy romance, or I'm not going to write a heavy romance. The book takes place over 2 or 3 days. But it's a thread that's there, and it is part of what Sophie will confront as she is evaluating who she is and how did she get in the situation she's in and what influence does he wind up having on her.
So how much like you is Sophie?
Sophie is a very extreme version of me. I hope I'm not exactly Sophie. But, you know, I like to write with humor. I grew up in an Italian family and household that was very sarcastic. And I think I have that as part of my default personality. So those aspects of Sophie are very similar. We share some of the same perspectives on publishing, having both been in the business for 10 years. I think Sophie is like, as if you push every aspect of my personality to its limit, that would be Sophie.
So was that fun for you to do that? You know, to
it like, really was.
Because in real life, you maybe have to hold yourself back sometimes, and in the story, you don't.
Yeah, you could say anything, do anything, and put it under Sophie. So I mean, it's. I think it's always fun. You know, a lot of times you hear like actors say it's more fun to play the villain than the good guy, and I think this is similar. Like, it's kind of fun to dig into somebody who is that. Somebody called her unhinged in the best way, and I was like, yeah, that's. It's just fun. You don't get to write that way very often, and you can't write every character that way. But when the time comes and it feels like it fits the character, it's just kind of fun to be sarcastic and witty and then have people take her down because she said something nasty to them. And, you know, it's just, it's a fun, it's a satire. So you can go more extreme places. And it really was just a blast for me to write.
Now, one of the main elements of the book is the impact of social media. And now, when did you start publishing?
My first book came out in 2015.
So has that aspect of like being an author changed in the 10 years since then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Instagram wasn't really a thing. I mean, I think it existed, but it was not something that authors are on in the way they are. There was no Bookstagram. There was no Book Talk. You know, Twitter was kind of the biggest thing that we were all on, and that's how readers, you know, would connect with you. And it was certainly part of promoting a book, but it was pre-pandemic. It was much more about the in-person interactions with fans, and especially in the YA world, which is what my first book was. There are these huge YA festivals that are day-long festivals, and you could have 50, 60 authors there. And I did a couple in Texas, and they would bus kids in from schools. There could be 4,000 or 5,000 kids coming to these festivals to meet authors of the highest level and debut authors. And it was such a community where you really felt immersed in the readership in person. And that was a lot more of what was going on. They would send authors on tour as groups. Very, very different than the way that I feel like we're very heavily into promoting and looking for readers on social media, which honestly, I still don't think is the best way to find readers. I think readers find the authors on social media after they read their books and like those authors and want to follow them. I don't think a brand new author has a lot of opportunity to find new readers on social media. It's just not how it works. Versus in person, when you're exposed to a huge group of people who are there because they love reading and they want to come together as a group and they want to, you know, experience new authors, I think it's a very different way of going about being in the book world and promoting the book world, you know, not to mention the effect that, you know, BookTok and Instagram have had on which books get, you know, attention and kind of all of that, and the way the publishers are now gravitating towards promoting books. So it's very, very different on really on every level.
Now, what about, you know, with Sophie, she has some unhinged behavior get captured by someone who came to a reading and then shared and going viral. Is that a danger? Is that something that you've seen happen to writers?
Oh, yes. I mean, constantly. It just happened to, there's a very big romance author called, her name is Allie Hazelwood, and this is just last week. She apparently was actually on an in-person panel and said something about how she felt about the love triangle in The Hunger Games. You know, and The Hunger Games is an old book by now, but obviously there's still rabid fans, and I love The Hunger Games. But readers didn't like what she had to say, and she got attacked on social media in very extreme ways about this kind of comment that she made. You know, I'm sure it was like a sarcastic, fun, you know, you're being funny in a group of people and you say something, and she got really attacked for it. And she shut down her social media account because the attack was just too much. And she said, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. And she apparently had a really big account with, you know, thousands and thousands of followers. And she was big in promoting other authors and doing what, you know, I'm talking about, that's hard to do, of get exposure to new readers. And she just shut her account down because, you know, she couldn't deal with it. So absolutely, this is happening. You know, I would say there's probably something at least a couple times a month with big name authors.
Wow. Well, Sophie handles it pretty well because she kind of distances herself from the social media accounts.
Yes. And she's not as active.
Yeah, well, her publicist kind of does it for her. Is that a common thing and something that you would recommend if somebody is at the position where they can afford to pay a publicist to do that rather than doing it themselves?
You know, I think it's all about time and what you enjoy. So if you don't like it, if you don't think you're good at it, you don't know what to post, you don't like doing videos, you know, some authors just love it and they're great at it. And, you know, you can learn so much about writing and about publishing from some of these people, in addition to just them, you know, talking about their books. So I think if you love it, I think you should go forward and do it. If it's not your thing and you'd rather be writing, but you want that presence, you can hire, you don't even have to hire a publicist. There are assistants, and especially, you know, younger assistants. I even used someone to help me with Love Theodosia, you know, someone who had just graduated college and was looking to make some money on the side. And she knew, you know, how to do it better than I did. And she was absolutely fantastic to work with. And I think you can do that to either supplement what you're doing or to just completely, you know, run it for you. But either way, you know, it really depends on, you know, how good you are at it and if you get enjoyment out of it or not.
Yeah. And I feel like, especially as harsh as people can be, it might be better not to invest personally in it.
Yeah, you know, and the danger is then everything becomes maybe too bland, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're so afraid to say anything, and so then, well, why have it if you're not going to, you know, say or do anything controversial? I think people find their lanes. Yeah, I'm gonna show fun pictures of my dog because that's like, you know, what I want to do, and I want people to get to know me through that aspect of my home life. So, you know, you can find a way to connect with your readers on something that is important to you, but it gets tricky. You know, there's a lot of social media out there and a lot of people who love you and a lot of people who just are looking to maybe stir controversy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard for me to understand why people want to be mean to other people online.
I think that's a worldwide thing right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It really is. So, you know, social media plays a role in here, but of course there's the other technology that is really the focal point of this is AI, artificial intelligence. Why did you want to write a book about that?
So it actually started with the idea of I had been in the business for nearly 10 years. I knew all of this inside publishing, and I knew that there was so much that happened behind the scenes that determines if a book is successful or not, as I talk about in the book. And I was at a point in my career where I was looking at, you know, I hadn't reached the level of success I had hoped for. And I knew part of it was this mechanics behind the scenes. And I was thinking about, you know, why did I not get the nod behind the scenes to get this marketing support? What could I do to get it? I was really evaluating where I was in the publishing world, and part of me wanted to write about it. I wanted to find some way to put all of this inside publishing and all my feelings about publishing into something. Would it be a book? Would it be an essay? What would I do with it? So that was kind of rolling around in my head. This was early 2023, and I was teaching one of my classes on Zoom, and it was a group I had worked with for a long time, so I knew them well and they knew me well. And one of them popped on the Zoom screen, and she just looked like so upset. And before I could even ask what was wrong, she said, "I don't even know why I'm doing this anymore. Why are any of us doing this?" And she was worried about AI. ChatGPT had recently come on the scene, and she said, "Will there be a job for an author, a human author, in 5 years, in 1 year, in 6 months?" And it was so new then, we didn't know much about it. You know, it's still evolving now. But when she came on the screen so worried about that, and we started to have discussions about AI in the creative space, and you know, then we had the Hollywood strike, and part of that was about AI. And so this kind of, these two things merged together for me of like, I want to tackle this idea of AI in the creative space and mixing it with this inside publishing knowledge. And I rolled it around in my head and came up with the premise I came up with. So that's kind of the origin of how it came together and why I wanted to write about it. Because, and I think if in order to understand how AI would change the role of an author and publishing, you need to first understand the role of an author in publishing. So it seemed like a perfect fit for these two things to go together.
Absolutely. So AI, is it writing books yet?
Yes. Yes. Again, there's so much in the news. Again, the past month has felt like all of this stuff coming about AI writing books. There was also, I don't know if you saw this, there was a summer reading list recommendation that was published in the Chicago Sun-Times.
Yes. And yeah, go ahead and finish that story.
No, it was, there were books on it that was published in the Chicago Sun-Times and then reprinted in other publications, because sometimes newspapers do that if it goes on a wire service. And so there were books that didn't exist, books with authors who were the wrong author, just completely not a valid, true list of books that were coming out this summer. And it turned out the freelancer, the writer who had used AI to create the list, didn't fact check it. And then, of course, the editor at the newspaper didn't fact check it. So this was published for all to see, you know, and that was just happened, you know, two or three weeks ago at the time we're, you know, talking right now.
Right.
So that's not creative, right?
Did those people lose their jobs?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Wow. Yeah.
But in terms of the creative space, you know, I think we'd be naive to think it wasn't happening. And tiny bit of evidence, again, around the same time as that Chicago Sun-Times happened, there were two self-published books, I believe, both found on Amazon, and not small, bigger books with good reviews on Goodreads and all of that. And each of them separately, just happened on the same week, was discovered that they had left an AI prompt in the published book that said, write this scene in the style of blah, blah, blah. So people have screenshots of that. The authors have since taken those books down, taken that out and put it back up. One of the authors said, you know, she wrote it. She was just looking for a way to kind of massage it. Not that she used AI to write the book, but there's been a lot of kind of veiled talk about a few authors, even bigger authors, who potentially have used AI to help them write their books. So, you know, I think it's there, and I think more are going to come out. And I wouldn't be surprised if, like in the book, someone comes out and just admits, this is what I did, and I used AI to write it.
Right. Now, like that Chicago Sun-Times article, what AI originally produces is rarely a finished product at this
you
point.
Have, at this point, although I will say it's getting a lot better. So when I was first writing this in early 2023, I was playing around with it to say, you know, give it something and say, what would the plot points be? Or write this scene. I wanted to see what it can do. And it was dreadful. We are now 2 years later, and I just did a presentation about the book and about the AI component of it. So I said, you know what, I want to see what it can do now. So I took my synopsis, which synopsis means the full story from start to finish. And this was probably about 5 pages of summarizing the novel. And I dropped that into one of the AIs. And I said, now write me the first like 2 or 3 pages of this. And so it did. And it was not the worst thing I've ever read. And so it was a little scary. And what was scary about it was it had tone. You know, so my book is written with humor. It's a satire. It was able to discern that from my synopsis, that this was going to be a book that had humor in it. And it had a couple of jokes that you wouldn't chuckle at. So that is somewhat terrifying for someone who makes their living writing books. Now, yeah. I presented those 2 versions for this presentation I did to a group of people, and a couple of people laughed at the jokes in the AI written one. And then I did present mine, and whether they're being kind or not, they all said, wow, yours is so much better. so I hope that's true. But the difference is you could see it was so much more fleshed out, leading to almost like a punchline, like leading somewhere rather than just like giving surface level of information. You could see that there was more baked in behind the scenes that you're going to continue to learn about. So, but if that's the change I saw in a couple of years, you know, where is it going to go?
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, I'm not the first person to say this a lot. It's been said before a lot of times is that we were, I think, hoping that robots, technology would replace the drudge work to free people up for creative work. And instead, it seems to be technology has been more successful at possibly replacing some of the creative work. And that's not, you know, what does that leave for humanity?
Yeah, you know, I think it's not discriminating against how it's being used. You know, people are using it to do coding. People are using it, you know, but that takes away a job from somebody too. You know,
that's been one of the biggest impacts so far is the loss of high level tech jobs.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, anybody whose job is being threatened to be replaced is going to be concerned about it. And in the creative space, it's writing, it's artists. You know, there have been artists who they're talking about using artists for doing graphic novels, like the art for graphic novels or book covers that replaces, you know, human jobs. I think a couple of publishers are thinking about or already doing it using AI voices to narrate the like translations of a book. So if my book were, you know, to go to Germany, they could use an AI voice to do the German audiobook translation of it. But that takes jobs away from people. You know, it's hard to develop a technology in a vacuum because the uses can be applied everywhere. So what we want to happen as a creative isn't necessarily the people who either use the technology or create it don't care. It can just be applied to anything. So I, you know, when I talk about this in terms of, you know, books specifically, but even artwork, it's really the marketplace that's going to be deciding if they want to be purchasing or using these, you know, or enjoying this art created by AI. You know, if people read it and they think it's great, and maybe it's cheaper because, you know, they didn't have to pay, you know, someone to write it or, you know, produce it, you know, depending on how they do it. You know, if the marketplace reads it, is that where we're going to go? You know, it's individual readers and consumers who are going to make the call here on what happens with it in the creative space.
I have some more thoughts about that. But first, I want to mention that we are on Writers' Voices. And our guest today is Laurie Gold, author of Romantic Friction. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, my day job, most of my career has been as an accountant and a business manager. And when I started with accounting, we had great big black ledger books, and every bookkeeping entry was entered by hand on this book, and then you totaled them, and then you transferred things onto a piece of paper to make the financial statements and so forth. And now all of that part of the job is handled by software. And and there are accountants, a lot of them, who really could not go back and do that. They don't have the behind the scenes understanding of what the accounting process really is. They know how to use the software, but they don't have that. But it didn't, I don't think it necessarily, I mean, maybe it took away jobs. Maybe there's, fewer people needed to do that work because it's all done so much faster. And also I did income tax returns by hand for clients, for customers, where if you wanted to make one change, you had to go back and erase and change every number after that. And now you can make changes very easily. So, but I guess the point was that what we ended up with is a better product because, you know, if you realize there was a mistake on an early part of a tax return that would feed into all these other forms, are you going to make that change if it's going to take you hours to do it and it's only, doesn't have a huge financial impact? And now it's so easy to make the change and get it correct. So, and same with the accounting too. It's so much easier to change something and get it more accurate. So maybe we have a better product and the people who used to do that work now are doing more analytical work and decision-making work. So maybe there's something like that that happens. Now, on the other hand, in my business life, I have factories, and automation, of course, has replaced some jobs, but it is actually really hard to get a robot to replace somebody on a production line. It's not easy to do, and it's very expensive, and things break down, and I could tell you huge long stories about how the automated lines, how problematic they can be. And so that's the other part of it where we thought we'd replace the drudge work, but that's in some ways the hardest part to do. Unless it's something that's very repetitive and it's exactly the same every time. But if there's any kind of decision making that has to be made, it can be challenging. To do. The parts have to be lined up the right way for the robot arm to pick them up. And if they're not, whereas a human can adjust to that easily.
That's very interesting. And when I think about, that and the limitations of AI in the creative space, there was a scene in Romantic Fiction that happens later in the novel and originally. And after we went through some edits, then my editor kind of came back to me and said, you know what? I think that should happen earlier. It's one of these changes that you think about, okay, I'm just going to move this scene earlier. Well, it's not as easy as that because there are, tentacles that go out into the novel that would have to change, whether it's, okay, this scene happens with two people and let's say they're having an argument here and we move that argument earlier. Every interaction with them after that now is tainted by the argument that now happens 50 pages earlier. So it's not just like a move and play. Everything changes. Emotional threads have to change. Interactions have to change. The plot points that came out of that argument are now happening earlier. So do we actually not include them all and include a couple, but we're going to leave those other couple plot points later in the book. So now where does that happen and who's involved in that scene? And I think about that change, which on its surface doesn't seem like a huge change, move this scene earlier, but the ramifications are quite large when you're working on a novel, that's 300 pages. And so I'm thinking about, as you were talking about what's hard for a computer or a robot to do, I don't know, when could AI do what I just described and understand all the implications and all the changes that would happen? Could it write the first draft? But then when you go in and say, okay, now do this and change this character art or move this plot point, I have a hard time seeing how it could really do it. Again, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, who knows? Yeah. But currently right now, I can't figure out how it would have done what I had to do to change that one scene in this book. And that's just one component of, writing and making a quality, piece of writing.
Now, on the other hand, how would you have made that change if you were writing everything by hand and not on a computer?
I know authors who still write their books by hand in notebooks. I don't understand how they do that.
Okay, first draft I can understand, but yeah. Do they, at what point are they putting it on the computer so that they can edit more easily? I mean, when I started, you know, I'm old enough that when I started writing, it was all on hand because there weren't any computers. And, I had notebooks where this is crossed out and this is circled in red and with big arrows and it goes here and, you know, but at some point you had to type it up and it's so much easier to have it, you know, even if I still like writing by hand sometimes, but I want to get it on the computer to do any editing. Do you know any authors that actually edit on paper?
I don't know. You know, I don't know how many edit on paper. When I first started out in 2015, my first novel, my editor, she was still doing edits by hand. So she would print out and she would write as you did it and circle and do all of this.
Yeah.
Now everybody uses the track changes function in Word. But you know, what's interesting to think about that is because sometimes people say, what's wrong with AI? It's just a tool. And I think what we're talking about shows that it's not the same as just a tool. A tool is what we're talking about. Microsoft Word, computer, Scrivener, whatever other programs you might want to write in. Track changes, great technology that allows us to actually do our job of writing books and editing books better and faster and easier. But AI isn't the same. It's not the same kind of software that we're talking about, because it's actually creating as opposed to helping you be the creator in a more efficient way. You know, some people might argue, well, if I ask it to make my scene better, you know, isn't that still me writing it? You know, and then you start getting into the nitty gritty of these discussions of like, is intention enough? If I come up with the scene, but it writes it, like, where does the line between my creative intention and someone else doing my job? You know, where is that? And those are, you know, you could have days and days long conversations kind of talking about that. And those are some of the debates that I have in Romantic Fiction and that they have these characters talking about. I wanted to spark these discussions. And the AI author does defend what she does and what AI can do. And the authors who aren't, you know, behind it give their side. And I wanted to show both sides the way I can picture them right now, because I want the reader to start thinking about it and I want them to have some of the discussions that you and I are having today.
And isn't there a real skill needed in directing the AI? Because you have to take what it comes back with, refine it, ask, you know, and ask it to, you know, to get what you really want.
Yeah.
And so that's a creative talent in a way too.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess you could say that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Someone said that to me. It's like, the more you know, the more you can get a better product. And I'm sure that's true. Whether it's true in a creative sense or whether it's more true in the, you know, mathematical or spreadsheet sense, you know, I don't know. I haven't played with it enough to kind of determine that.
Oh, definitely. It is definitely true. Now can we really tell if something's AI produced by AI or iron? You know, is a reader going to be able to tell?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. There was this whole thing that went around recently of like, oh, you could tell it's AI because it uses M dashes, as if novels and writers don't ever use an M dash. So I was like, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah. I read something too about how to tell if something was AI, but I can't remember what it said now.
I did have a teacher at one of my events, and she said that they, because, you know, kids are using it in school and they're using it for homework and you're trying to figure out how to get them not to write their essays with it. And she did say there are programs that they can run things through to help identify it. Yeah, I'm not the most knowledgeable about what they are and what they're picking out, you know, and because I think, you know, it's somewhat subjective too, whether you like something or not. So like, that's not it is subjective. So like, that's not I liked it or not. That's not a way to know if it's AI. I don't think there's certain words that I know of that are like clues. You know, I think this is why it's scary for writers, because there isn't a way to tell right now, or I don't think there is.
So I just put into Google how to tell if something is written by AI, and the AI overview that I get back says, to determine if text is likely AI generated, look for repetitive language, generic explanations, unusual sentence structures, and a lack of a distinct personal voice or emotional depth. So that's what AI says about itself. Also, inconsistencies in tone and style, buzzwords and overly formal language, and inaccurate facts, also known as hallucinations. And that's the one that, you know, that Sun, that Chicago Sun article, you know, had inaccurate facts. And you just, it's like, it's very hard now to go and check a fact without having AI be the one checking the facts. So how do you know? Are we caught in this loop?
Well, you know, when I was a journalist before I, you know, started writing novels, and you know, when I was taught in school and college, you know, you had to have three confirmed sources for every, you know, thing you put in there. And so, you know, that was usually people, you know, that was people confirming something. Sometimes people, I think actually had to have two people and one source, you know, one independent source, and this was before Wikipedia, so you weren't using that, but Wikipedia has its own issues. That's not really a trusted source. So where are you going to, like, to get these things? And especially then, is it a cycle that feeds on itself? Because you think, well, the New York Times, they're always going to be right. So if it's said in there, then that's true. But if you spin this out as years and years go by, like, can you always count on these sources that were your go-to, you know, sure, reputable, confirmed sources? You know, these are the things I think about that kind of just make my head spin.
Absolutely. Lori, before we run out of time, would you like to read a little bit from Romantic Friction?
Sure. So we've been talking a bit about the inside publishing. So that was the selection I chose.
Great.
So we can hear that. Let me find my right page here. So this is going to be after the main character of Sophie Wilde has discovered that the author named Hartley West has used AI to write in her style. And she's with her friend Roxanne in Roxanne's living room above the bookstore that she owns. And she kind of enters into a rant. She's had a cocktail or two, and she enters into a rant about publishing. So this is where we'll start, kind of at the start of her rant. I am the top-selling fantasy romance author in the country. We're fielding offers from television studios right now. My books will become three-dimensional. My words will exit the mouths of famous actors with smoldering eyes and high cheekbones. They will snap selfies with me and praise my work, even though we all know that in the early days, they would have let me and my scorpion-loving peasant die of thirst or dysentery or zombie disembowelment without a whisper of regret. I did all of this. Me. Not some machine. In the middle of the bookstore, all the air leaves my lungs. It's here where Hartley admitted to my quote-unquote loyal readers that she used artificial intelligence to write a book that would feel like mine. I expected them to wage a war on my behalf and renounce Hartley West as a charlatan. I expected them to defend me, my art, my life, which are all one and the same. Instead, by the time we regrouped, every single person had my book as well as hers in our signing line. Traitors. The bottle of bourbon is still in my hand. I upend it and guzzle. Roxanne startles me. Easy there, she says, appearing in front of me. I hear a ringing in between my ears, and there's no easy here, there, or anywhere. I'm circling the store, pulling books off of the rolling partitions, muttering to myself because Hartley West is a complete and utter imposter, and no one cares. In fact, everyone loves her. In just a couple of days, she's dismantled everything I spent years building. She's made a farce of my life's work, and that of every other author who actually uses their minds and hearts and souls despite overdrawn bank accounts and advances that wouldn't even buy a Dyson. But it's fitting, isn't it? Laughter bubbles up my throat as I say to Roxanne, why should this be any different from anything else in this industry? It's all an illusion. At least this time the readers are in on it. At least Hartley admitted the truth. That's something. Can you imagine any of these authors actually telling the truth about their success? Like this one? I hold up a book and point to the fleur-de-lis stamp on the front. A Riley Reid, some actress turned literary expert by way of Instagram. She's rivaling Reese and Jenna and all the rest for dominance in the book recommendation space. She's never featured one of my books, ever. But this one, this drivel about a woman trekking across the country to forage for mushrooms with her dachshund Wiggles, a Riley Reid for her debut. And do you know why? Roxanne's eyes leave mine, float to the other side of the store as if she's contemplating making a run for it. Her husband's a producer, I say. Rights were sold. Riley Moore attached to star before the publisher even signed on. This Bill Bryson ripoff will be trending on every poor sucker's Netflix, and they'll have no idea it was all rigged. I drop the book on the floor, snatch another. And this one? On the cover, two people lock lips on the bow of a cruise ship. With my hand to my forehead, I mimic one of the influencer blurbs on the back. So dreamy. I was on a panel with the author, and she went on and on about how word of mouth led to her book becoming a hit out of nowhere, an organic reader-fold sensation. I tossed the book on the floor. Her publisher paid those influencers, each and every one. She bragged about it after. I reached for another with a forlorn-looking woman stroking a piano on the cover. And this? Every interview the author waxes on about her inspiration. A musician mother with paralyzing stage fright. Lie, outright. Package her all the way from story idea to story beats to character arcs. They hired her to write it, and no one knows. Roxanne stands, Sophie, these are interesting insights, but I think, interesting, it's criminal. My hands dart out, grabbing book after book. At least political ads have to tell you who paid for them. I fling a book to the ground. TikTokers paid for Big Five. Or is it four now? Three? And there goes another. Instagrammers paid. I toss another. Celebs. Paid, paid, paid. I seize another book and pause. It's a title I've never heard of. Oh, Roxanne, you truly are salt of the earth, aren't you? She does this. Stocks the books that have less support than a bra from the dollar store. The books that aren't projected on billboards in Times Square. The ones that aren't coincidentally reviewed everywhere from the New York Times to the Washington Post to Cosmo in the same week. The ones whose advanced reader copies aren't printed in the thousands and sent to influencers and celebrities in special boxes that spew glitter and nestle the book amid eye serums and cashmere throws and bubble baths in the character's favorite scent. The ones that aren't granted all of these marketing efforts upon acquisition, preordained as bestsellers before the book even hits the shelves. Roxanne does what she can to support the books that get dropped in the publisher's next season catalog with as much fanfare as an advertisement for Hemorrhoid Cream, just waiting for someone to believe in them. I clutch the book. From the land of misfit toys, an unsupported book, a single copy ordered by a bookstore owner with a soft heart. It will linger here, gathering dust until it finally makes its way to the 75% off bin, where someone will find it and use its pages to line their parakeet's cage. The author to be crapped upon once again. I balance this sad sap of a book out on the shelf, face out. Here's your chance, little one. Godspeed. Yes, well, Roxanne says, her voice tight. Lessons for us all, but I need to close up shop. She starts walking toward me, and I bolt to the bestseller's table at the front of the store, where the first nine of my Weight of Feathers and Stone books are artfully displayed among a handful of others. Paid, I say, tapping the nearest, and then each one in succession, including my own. Paid, 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 and oh, right, paid. The same books at the front of every single store, because the publisher paid for them to be. And yes, my books are here too, so am I as guilty as the rest of them? No, Roxanne winces, but I can't lower my voice any more than I can stop. I worked for this. Writing a book using AI? A coward's move. A brainless coward's move. And yet readers are too stupid to see it. They have murdered us one and all. I bring my hand to my chest and bow my head. Here lies the remains of a breed of human we once called author. They are no more. Extinct. Rest in peace. In one fluid motion, I sweep my arm across the table and send bestsellers flying. Roxanne gasps in front of me, and someone else does from behind. I turn. A cell phone looms high in the air, filming my every word. The middle-aged woman from my earlier event stares at me, jaw open. My mother-in-law, she stutters. She hasn't started the series yet, and in all the fuss, I forgot to get her a copy of the first book, so I thought I would just come back and... I swipe the first book in my series off the floor and hand it over. Here. Would you mind signing it? Yes, I would.
And that's Lori Gold reading from Romantic Friction. So... another thing that you kind of get into in the book quite a bit is support for new writers. And it sounds like you offer a lot of support for new writers. You want to tell us a little bit about the things that you do?
Yes. So I started teaching about 10 years ago. I'm in the Boston area for an organization called Grub Street. And I say that I pity all the students who had me when I first started teaching because I knew nothing. And I had no right kind of teaching writing. But now here I am 10 years later, and I'm much more confident in my teaching and also in what students need and what they need as new writers. And so I still teach creative writing, but I also have come to realize that students are really looking for this community. As I discuss in the book, writers really want other writers to talk with, to learn from, to commiserate with, to celebrate with. And it's very hard to find that community. You know, I found a lot of the people who became my writing friends on Twitter. It was a very different place then. It was a long time ago. It was back in 2013. But it's not the same right now. And it's hard to find people online. It's hard to find find people in person, even, you know, recommendations of taking a class, and you'll find other people who are like you to kind of work with and become your writing community. But that's even hard because depending on who's in that class, you don't always have that bond that you need in order to have the trust you need in order to put your work with before somebody else. And so what I've started doing in the past couple of years, especially, is forming these small groups where I help lead them together. And I call them my AAA class, accountability, advice, and accomplices. So they meet without me to develop their community, and they meet with me to get advice. And they'll share whether it's they want to work on a plot point, they want to talk about character, they want to share actual pages, and we work as a small group. And as I do this, more and more, these students then leave me and stay with each other. And that's just fantastic. And that's what I'm hoping to do. And this is kind of where I felt like I can really help people come together, as well as help their writing on this kind of like small scale level. And that led to me now doing writing retreats. Sometimes they're full day writing retreats in the Boston area where I live. Sometimes we do it on Zoom so I can have more people who don't live here. And then I do a weekend long writing retreat with a friend of mine. We do it together on Cape Cod. And a lot of these people just really want to come together and be together in a room and just write together. It's a very generative based writing retreat. It's not a lot of instruction. We have a little of it, but people really just say, I want to be in a community of other writers. And it's been fantastic. It's great for me to kind of interact with writers on this level as well. I learn so much about my own writing by helping other people work through their plot points, because the more you do it, the more you kind of get used to understanding, like, that's how story works, and you get able to brainstorm quicker and faster when you're working with other people. And it's so much improved my own writing as a result of doing the work that I do teaching.
So you don't feel like it takes time away from your writing?
It definitely does. It's a choice. You know, fortunately, I can decide how much I want to teach, because a lot of times either I sign up for classes to teach through the organization I teach at, but it's on me to go to sign up. It's not assigned if I were a college professor that I would have a set amount of classes. I choose how many I want to do each semester. I choose how many I want to run myself. So I have control over my schedule, which I'm fortunate to be able to do. But it is a choice to say, like, I could write something else, or I could write more if I were not doing it. But you know, I want a community as well. And this is my opportunity to stay active in the writing world. In addition to, you know, the joy you get from helping other writers, it's personal joy for me to be interacting with a lot of these people who are repeat students or, you know, become friends as well. So it's almost like a social outlet for me in a job that is very, you know, singular,
solitary.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So Lori, what's next for you in your writing? Will you do more YA? Are you going to stick with the book club fiction? More
I'm
historical
with the book
fiction.
Historical fiction eventually, but I was so inspired. That was like, I call my passion project. It's a one-off. I never thought I would write historical fiction, but I just got captured by the story and kind of really had to do it. I always saw myself gravitating from YA into this book club fiction. So it took me a little bit to get here after writing that. But so I'm going to stay here. I have another book with HarperCollins that'll come out next April. That's called Kiss, Marry, Kill, based on the conversational game of that title, if anyone is knowledgeable about it. it's a game where usually you pick celebrities or college friends. So you say, out of Ryan Gosling, Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Seacrest, who would you kiss? Who would you marry? Who would you kill? So it's a pretty popular game. A lot of times on the younger people. And so my book is a play on that game. And instead of picking three other people, they say they're at their summer outing, three best friends and founders of a health and wellness app, and they're about to go public on Wall Street. And so they're at their summer outing a week before they go public. And the one woman says they're going to play this game. But instead of picking one person picking among three people, she says, one, woman one, who would you kiss out of anybody here? Woman two, who would you marry out of anybody here? Woman three, who would you kill out of anybody here? And they each make a choice, and then they wake up in an alternate universe having each done the thing that they've said.
Oh, my. So what defines book club fiction?
So book club fiction some people say, is it just women's fiction? Well, we're trying not to use the word women's fiction anymore, because anybody can read a book. But it's not plain. I mean, it doesn't have to be contemporary fiction. So it's not contemporary because it could be historical. The idea is that it sparks conversation. So it's something your book club could read that you would then want to say, oh, can you believe the character did this? Or, you know, the book I just talked about is about choice. How do we make choice? What are the ramifications of our choices? There are themes that are relevant to our lives that can spark discussion. And I think that's what encompasses book club fiction. So, and not genre fiction in the way like a detective or a murder mystery would be. So that's kind of the distinction there.
Okay. Now, are there any other genres that you would like to experiment with in the future?
I think, you know, after doing romantic fiction, I did enjoy doing like the banter between the, you know, the couple who comes to be in the couple. And I could see doing some sort of rom-com because I love writing dialogue and I love infusing humor. So I feel like that's an area that I could definitely go into.
That doesn't seem like it would be too much of a leap for you. So do you have any sort of advice in very succinct advice for somebody who wants to break into publishing?
You know, this sounds cliche. I'm not going to say you have to read a lot, but you do have to read a lot. But the other thing you have to do is learn about the industry. So it's one thing to say you want to write. And if you want to write and you just want to, you love it and it's going to live on your computer, maybe your friends or family are going to read it. That's a different category of writer. If you're a writer who is seeking publication, as you asked, on traditional publishing, self-publishing as well, because this is a competitive industry for self-publishing as well. You need to dive into how these industries work. It's not just about writing. It is about marketing and how books are acquired. And if you're self-publishing, how do I do that successfully? There is so much about the business of publishing that shouldn't be a surprise if you're trying to actually make it as a career. So I say immerse yourself in learning about the business side of publishing. And that can be done by following agents, whether it's on social media. Many agents, not so many editors that I know, but a lot of agents have Substacks now, and they're really breaking down what happens in the industry. And those are great places to start to learn about the industry, as well as following authors. I talk about the inside publishing on my Instagram, and so do many other authors. So start following other authors, follow these agents to really learn about the business of publishing.
And one fun way to get your feet wet on learning about the business of publishing is read Romantic Friction by Laurie Gold.
Thank you. Yes, hopefully. Yeah, someone told me it feels like a course on publishing.
Well, we always close with the quote, and I found one about artificial intelligence from Alan Kay. I don't know who that is, but I want to give him credit. Some people worry that artificial intelligence will make us feel inferior. But then, anybody in his right mind should have an inferiority complex every time he looks at a flower.
I love that.
So thank you so much for being with us again, Laurie.
Thank you. It was so great to talk to you.
And look forward to your next book.
Thank you.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.